Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. It is most likely that everyone listening to this program, and millions more throughout Oregon and the USA, are aware that Bill Walton has died. He was certainly a great athlete, regarded nearly on a par with the Greek Olympians of ancient yore. And he was also a friendly, gregarious, good-humored, and very decent Homo sapien. Today's program occurs on the original date for Memorial Day, before the hucksters enlarged it into a three-day spending spree, which also begins the summer silly season. On this occasion of national memory, I start today's program with a roster of American war dead, not their names as appear on the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C., and on local war memorial efforts throughout the USA, but the gross numbers in each war since the Revolution, which was tallied by InfoPlease on the Internet a few years ago. So more casualties might well be discovered, and no one will ever really know how many Vietnamese were killed, North and South, in that war. America's wars, U.S. casualties and veterans. American Revolution, 1775 to 1783. Total service members, 217,000. Battle deaths, 4,435. Non-mortal woundings, 6,188. War of 1812, 1812 to 1815. Total service members, 286,730. Battle deaths, 2,260. Non-mortal woundings, 4,505. Indian Wars, approximately from 1817 to 1898. Total service members, 106,000. Battle deaths, 1,000. Mexican War, 1846 to 1848. Total service members, 78,718. Battle deaths, 1,733. Other deaths in service, non-theater, 11,550. Non-mortal woundings, 4,152. Civil War, 1861 to 1865. Total service members, Union, 2,213,363. Battle deaths, also Union, 140,414. Other deaths in service, non-theater, again, Union, 224,097. Non-mortal woundings, Union, 281,881. Total service members, Confederacy, 1,050,000. Battle deaths, also Confederate, 74,524. Other deaths in service, non-theater, Confederate, 59,297. Non-mortal woundings, also Confederate, unknown. Spanish-American War, 1898 to 1902. Total service members, 306,760. Battle deaths, 385. Other deaths in service, non-theater, 2,061. Non-mortal woundings, 1,662. World War I, 1917 to 1918, and that was America's single year in that war, which started in 1914. Total service members, 4,734,991. Battle deaths, 53,400. 402. Other deaths in service, non-theater, 63,114. Remember, that was when the flu struck, the worldwide influenza epidemic. Non-mortal woundings, 204,002. Living veterans, when this thing was made, fewer than 500, but I doubt there are any left anymore. World War II, 1940 to 1945. Total service members, 16,112,566. Battle deaths, 291,557. Other deaths in service, non-theater, 113,842, which apparently seems to be a total of 405,399 engaged in that war. Non-mortal woundings, 671,846. Korean War, 1950 to 1953. Total service members, 5,720,000. Serving in theater, 1,789,000. Battle deaths, 33,741. Non-mortal woundings, 103,284. Vietnam War, 1964-1965. Total service members, 8,744,000. Serving in theater, 3,403,000. Battle deaths, 47,410. Other deaths in service, 10,789. Non-mortal woundings, 153,303. Gulf War, 1990 to 1991. Total service members, 2,183,000. Serving in theater, 665,476. Battle deaths, 147. Other deaths in service, 1,565 plus 382. Non-mortal woundings, 467. America's wars total. Military service during war, 42,348,460. Battle deaths, 651,008. Other deaths in service, 13,998. Non-mortal woundings, 1,431,290. And what I have just read is a tally of America's war dead so far, and there are probably many errors in those countings. And now, from something I wrote, Vanport, the town nobody wanted. One of the world's worst examples of city planning was Vanport, Oregon, the city where Portland's Delta Park is now. When it was dramatically submerged like a latter-day Atlantis on Memorial Day in 1948, Vanport had a population of almost 20,000 persons, all of whom were made homeless by the rampaging Columbia and Willamette Rivers in less than an hour and a half. A faulty dike system was the cause of Vanport's death. The water poured through a break in an old railroad embankment, and for weeks, Vanport was at the bottom of a lake. Vanport was the second largest city in Oregon during World War II, a war baby born of the necessity for housing some 40,000 workers for Henry J. Kaiser's shipyards in Portland and Vancouver, Washington. Former Portland Mayor Earl Riley described it as the largest housing project in the nation. Vanport was built in 1942 on marshy lowlands along the Columbia River, less than 2 miles from where the Columbia merges with the Willamette River. Touted as the miracle city on the Columbia that Kaiser built, Vanport was never more than a huge collection of cracker box houses strung together fast and cheap, according to one of its residents. But from its inception, Vanport was more than just a war baby. It was a bastard child. It had no mayor or city council, but was instead administered by the Portland Housing Authority. It had no local industry, except for gas stations and grocery stores. It had a population of blue-collar workers, at least one-fourth of whom were blacks, recruited by Kaiser from southern states. After the war, Portland used Vanport as the dumping ground for human waste, a former resident said. By the time the flood wiped us out, it was almost all low-cost housing for the poor. The City of Roses made no pretense of hiding its fears that Vanport was a slum in the making, a potential cesspool of crime, a debaser of real estate values, and a prospective leech on the tax roll, Walter Matula wrote in the Oregon Journal a year after the flood. Matula, who had lived in Astoria, also wrote about the Great Astoria Fire of 1922. As the largest housing project in the nation, Vanport could become the biggest municipal headache of its time, Portland Mayor Riley said in October 1945. Julia Rutila, who was fired from her job with the State Welfare Division for her investigative reporting of the flood, said that after the war, the power structures in Portland and Vancouver wanted all the blacks to go back where they came from. Many of them did, she said, but at least one-fourth of Vanport's population at the time of the flood was black. The other largest single group was veterans who came to Vanport after the war and could not find jobs. Because of that situation, one-fourth of the city was on welfare. I think that because the majority of Vanport's population was poor, Ms. Rutila continued, black and white, whether on welfare or working at low-paying jobs, the housing authority just did not care to meet its responsibilities to the people. Never has a city grown so big so fast, lived so short a life, and died so suddenly with so little loss of life, Leverett Richards wrote about Vanport in the Oregonian on the 20th anniversary of the Memorial Day flood. At least a score of Vanport's residents died in the flood. Thousands lost everything they owned. It might seem that the planners who built a city in a swamp between two rivers would deem flood control as a first priority. All we had in Vanport was a makeshift, leaky dike system and no little Dutch boy to plug it with his finger, a survivor said 20 years after the disaster. The dike that broke had been an old railroad embankment constructed of sand and soft earth that was, quote, never intended to resist the powerful lateral hydraulic pressure of a flood or protect a town, unquote, an editorial in the Portland Sun said 3 days after the dike burst. The Oregon media agonized over the Vanport disaster, but all it could do was raise questions for which there were obvious answers, and just as obvious a desire to avoid them. Former Oregonian reporter Bob Clark, whose Vanport home was destroyed by the flood, posed one of the questions a month later. We have learned that the Columbia long had regarded these murky bottoms as her own property, he wrote. We have been told that she swept through from time to time when the Snake, Willamette, or other tributaries dumped too much water into her main channel. Did the men who built Vanport know that? Clark asked. Julia Rutila said they did. She said several members of the Army Corps of Engineers had warned the Housing Authority before Vanport was built that the area was one of calculated risk. But I don't think they really cared, she said. Portland didn't want the blacks, neither did Vancouver. That was one of the main reasons Vanport was built, and I seriously believe a reason the Housing Authority chose to go ahead and build the city in that area of calculated risk. Hours before the floodwaters swept through Smith Lake, Army engineers and Housing Authority officials inspected the dike and reported in good shape, quote unquote. By that time, the Housing Authority had moved its records out of Vanport and the supermarkets moved their safes, Julia Rutila said. All they left behind were the people. Residents had become increasingly worried when the rivers began rising before the fateful Memorial Day. Unseasonal runoff of late snow and several days of heavy rains had swollen the Columbia and Willamette rivers to levels not reached since the 1894 flood that inundated Portland. To counter growing demands for evacuation of Vanport by its residents, the Housing Authority responded with a handbill that was delivered from door to door proclaiming, "The dikes are safe at present. You will be warned if necessary. You will have time to leave. Don't get excited," quote unquote. The executive board of the Vanport Tenants League filed suit against the Housing Authority a month after the flood. The case, which never reached the courts, demanded the Housing Authority be held legally responsible for not having evacuated the people of Vanport prior to the flood, not having provided an adequate warning system, and for having issued reassuring statements denying any immediate danger. When people talk or write about Vanport, they only talk about the flood, a survivor said. They don't deal with the fact that thousands of us were homeless or were forced to live in trailers or in barracks on Swan Island for months afterward. The Housing Authority did nothing to find replacement housing. We had to find it for ourselves, which was almost impossible because of housing shortages and the fact most of us were financially wiped out by the flood. Ms. Rutila, a reporter for the Longshoreman Dispatcher since 1946, was fired from her job with the State Welfare Division because she wrote that the victims, quote, were left entirely to their own devices with no aid from public agencies, unquote. The Welfare Division had declared the flood was a natural disaster and that the refugees were not entitled to relief, she said. The Red Cross took the same position. Churches and schools threw open their doors, and several people took some victims into their homes, but there were thousands. Ms. Rutila said she and an Associated Press reporter went to the director of the Housing Authority after the flood and suggested that vacant hotel rooms in Portland be used to temporarily house the Vanport refugees. He told us he couldn't do it because the rooms were reserved for Rose Festival visitors, she said. The Army Corps of Engineers says there will never be another flood like the Memorial Day flood of 1948. They say the 14 major dams on the Columbia River and its main tributaries will resist another flood of Vanport proportion. As for Vanport's graveyard, it was designated for recreational land use because no one wanted to live there anymore. Delta Park and a racetrack replaced the drowned city. The destruction of Vanport houses was long overdue, Dr. Richard M. Steiner, who was pastor of Portland's first Unitarian Church at the time of the flood, told his congregation and the Oregon Journal a month afterward, "The tragedy lies in the destruction of lives and personal property," he said. "A different housing authority, more concerned for the people and less concerned for real estate values would have long since created permanent housing for low-income groups in our city. The city of Portland still has not met that responsibility. In fact, the city is literally flooded with contrary populations of homeless victims of gentrification and home-seeking newcomers wanting to buy or rent rapidly diminishing home stocks, a situation similarly developing in Astoria. As for the black population flooded out of Vanport, many refused deportation from Portland or Oregon and moved into northeast Portland, where many black families had displaced earlier white residents and, despite considerable blight and prejudice, have developed a significantly vigorous and flowering community known as Albina. And that was something I wrote. Vanport, the town nobody wanted. And Julia Rutila, who was born in 1907, was a significant part of Northwest labor history for more than 60 years, since she was a child passing out IWW leaflets. She was a small, quietly spoken woman who served on countless picket lines and in as many defense committees for jailed union men and women. She was arrested often and the victim of labor violence by police and strikebreakers. She wrote for the Union Press for more than half a century. She was also active in anti-Vietnam War and pro-humanistic issues, leader of a cohort of elderly women who often wore black and appeared everywhere there was opposition to unjust social, political, and military policies. When she was 80, she expressed wonder she had lived so long and concluded her longevity was due to her white-hot anger at political impropriety and insensitive stupidity, which kept her blood clean. She lived in Astoria for many years and in Portland after that. She died in Alaska in 1991, actively protesting the Persian Gulf War. In 1974, at my request as editor of Metropolis Magazine, published by Portland State University, earlier known as Vanport College, Julia wrote a remarkable narrative about Northwest labor history of the first part of the 20th century, The Sweat and Blood of Labor, which was subsequently reprinted four times in my newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle, September 1982, 1986, 1994, and 2003, and I have read it several times on this program honoring Labor Day. In 2003, Sandy Polishuk wrote a book about Julia, Sticking to the Union, an oral history of the life and times of Julia Rutila. Walter Matula was a newspaper man. He wrote for the Astoria Budget, the Oregon Journal, and the Oregonian. In the early 1960s, he worked for the great but short-lived strike newspaper, The Portland Reporter. He was a founder of the Finnish American Historical Society in Portland and wrote articles and books about the Northwest Finnish community, among them Finns and Finnegans, boarding house Finns, Uniontown Finns, Indians, Finns, and their Thunderbirds, illustrated by Amy Matula. He was also author of Sam Newhut, Empire Builder. He died in 1974 at age 69. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is this program's engineer. I wish to end this program with a sayonara to Barry Romo, who was once upon a time head honcho of Vietnam Veterans Against the War. He died on May Day at age 76, a number sanctified in America's origin lore. He was an Army infantry lieutenant who was decorated with a Bronze Star. As a VVAW member, He went to Hanoi in December 1972 and delivered Christmas letters to American POWs and was forced to find shelter during intense American bombing raids on the city. He also attempted to get compensation for Agent Orange victims in Vietnam and for American vets suffering PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Happy Memorial Day.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times-Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.